The majority of the Christians I know would not describe their lives as flowing with milk and honey. You know, peaceful pastures and gardens where the herds graze and the bees gather pollen and make honey. Instead, I think they might describe their lives as dry and barren, like a desert. That's sad. That's really sad. But you know what's even more sad? Is that most of them don't seem to mind. They've accepted that. They've settled for that. A great deception has been perpetrated on God's people to the extent that it's common to believe that forgiveness of sin and the promise of heaven are the sum total of what the Christian faith is all about. Well, let me tell you, that is a lie right from the pit of hell. The enemy would just love to have you and me and every believer believe that that's all it means to be a Christian. Now, don't get me wrong. Forgiveness of sin and the hope of eternity ought to light your fire. But to believe the lie that that's the full extent of what Jesus' death and resurrection accomplished is like taking a loan out on a brand new car and then letting it sit in the driveway or the garage. You got some driving to do. You got places to go, people to see. A car wasn't designed, built, and sold to sit parked in somebody's driveway. But there are so many Christians who settle for leaving their faith in the driveway, parked, not going anywhere. Now, some don't know any better. It's a question of education or influence. Some are afraid or unsure. Some don't know where they'd go or how they would get there. Some don't believe the car would start, let alone take them where they want to go. Some just don't want to go anywhere, and they refuse to even put the key in the ignition. In the Old Testament, Israel was rescued from a cruel existence because they believed and obeyed God about the power in the blood of the Passover lamb. They believed, and they were rescued, and they did cross the sea, and they ate the manna, and they ate the quail, and they drank the water from the rock. They built the tabernacle, and they worshiped in it, offered sacrifices and all the rest. But for an entire generation, that's as far as their faith would take them. In Exodus 3, and we looked at this last week, God promised Moses two things, promised Israel two things. First, that they would leave Egypt, and that they would enter the land he'd promised to Abraham hundreds of years earlier. And we've read the story. They believed God about the blood. They obeyed God about leaving Egypt and crossing the sea. But once they got out of Egypt, they stopped believing and they stopped obeying. And so what should have been an 11-day walk to the promised land turned into 40 days of wandering in the desert until all of that first generation, all of those unbelievers, including Moses, were gone. They deserted Egypt, but they refused to desert the desert. And you have to know that with every prayer, every song, every sacrifice they offered, it must have been a bittersweet thing for God. Because even though they believed in him, they wouldn't believe on him. And what I mean by that is that they believed he existed, but they didn't trust him to lead them where he said he would lead them or give them what he said he would give them. And that is exactly where the majority of my Christian friends are, you believers and church workers and pastors, and it doesn't matter. That's just their reality. They've trusted the blood of Jesus to rescue them from their sin, but they're stuck in the desert, worshiping, offering prayers, even serving the Lord, but never believing God for the other half, the second half of his promise to Moses and to Abraham, never going one step beyond a parked in the driveway fire insurance kind of faith. Now, there is a land, there is a life that's rich with power, it's teeming with joy. It's a life of overcoming, a life of victory, a life of triumph and thrills and challenges and adventure. And just like forgiveness and the hope of eternity with the Lord, that life is yours by faith, by believing God's promise and acting on that belief. Joshua 2 now is about preparing to leave the desert and live in the land. And if you're ready to believe all of God's promises and experience all that he has for you, then today could be the beginning of a whole new understanding of what it means to call yourself a Christian. Now, we're going to break this chapter into three parts. The first thing we see is this: when you're ready to leave the desert, you're going to find out what you're getting into. Joshua 2:1 says, "Now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, 'Go, view the land, especially Jericho.' So they went, came to the house of a harlot named Rahab." Now I'm sure you're probably used to saying Rahab. And if you're from Italy, then you probably say Italian too. And believe me, I will no doubt say Rahab just out of habit, but her name was... I look at it this way. If you go to heaven and say, "I want to talk to Rahab," they'll go, who? What are you talking about? If you say, "I want to talk to Rahab," "Oh, Rahab from Jericho. Okay, we got you." So, Rahab, and they lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they've come to search out all the country." And then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, "Yeah, the men came to me, but I didn't know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out. And where the men went, I don't know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." But she brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax, which she laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Okay, you're going to leave the desert, then you got to find out what you're getting into. Can we see that map? Let's get the lay of the land here. You can see at the top there, that little blue kidney-shaped thing, the Sea of Galilee, that black line is the Jordan River, and at the bottom is the Dead Sea. You can see Jerusalem on the left up at the top of the mountains there, and Jericho down at that's the bottom of the hill, closer to the river, Gilgal. And across the way there, you see Acacia, the Acacia Grove. Some of your Bibles may have a different name, but it's a Hebrew word that means the grove of the acacias, or the place of the acacia trees. So that's where we're talking. Now on your right, which would be the east, that east and south is where Israel has been wandering for 40 years. And now they've come here about to enter in the land, and they're at Acacia. That's what we learn from verse 1. Joshua sent two men out from Acacia Grove. Does that sound a little familiar, that part of the story? He sent them out, sent spies. Remember Numbers 13? Back when Israel had just recently left Egypt and they reached the banks here before they were kept from going in, Moses sent 12 spies to spy out the land. Joshua only sends two. I think because out of that 12, only two of them saw through eyes of faith. The other 10, if you remember the story, said, oh, there are giants over there. You know, yeah, it's a nice place. You know, the grapes are this big and really would be a nice place to take over. But there's no way we can, you know, and they were right. Because in their own strength, there was absolutely no hope whatsoever that they could go in and conquer Jericho or any of the other towns. But see, the two remembered that God was in on this deal. And if God was leading, if God was directing, then whatever seemed impossible for them would be more than possible for the Lord. Those two were trusting God's promise that they wouldn't be on their own. But the majority ruled, the 10 won, and because of that failure to trust God, that failure to obey God and go in and take the land, that's why they spent 40 years in the desert. So Joshua now doesn't send 12, he sends two. He knew who they were, he knew their hearts, he knew they were faithful men, and they wouldn't come back with some kind of fraidy cat story about how this isn't going to, we're not going to be able to do this. He knew these were guys who trusted the Lord. See, faith in God is rarely, if ever, blind. God rarely, if ever, asks us to exercise an uninformed or unintelligent faith. And that reminds me of something we've touched on in our Wednesday night study. You know, Jesus modeled this very principle about know what you're getting into. You remember that when Jesus met his first two followers there, they were followers of John the Baptist, and John said, he must increase, I must decrease, and the two guys, if I remember right, it's John and Andrew. They said, where are you going? I mean, we want to follow you. And Jesus said, well, come and see. Just come and see. Just come with me and, you know, watch what goes on and just check it out, pretty much. And it wasn't for 4 months. 4 months later, when Jesus made that sweep through the upper Galilee, Capernaum, and found that by this time John and Andrew, and along with Simon and James, they're back fishing. They're back home fishing. And it's 4 months after that first come and see invitation that he goes around and he says, well, come and follow me. They had 4 months to think about this thing. They had 4 months to watch what he did and how he did it and find out who he was. He didn't ask him to come and follow me the first time he ever saw him. He said, come and see. And then after a season, after an opportunity to come and see, when he said, come and follow me, then that wasn't just a knee-jerk reaction. They left their nets, they left their families, they left their home, and they followed him, and they made an informed decision. They knew what they were getting into. That's always part of God's plan. Now, you know the parable of the soils, of the sower and the soils. Those seeds that sprout up quickly die away just as quickly. But those seeds that put in deep roots, they grow up and they're strong and they can withstand the wind and the sun and everything else. There's this principle of find out what you're getting into. Moses sent 12, Joshua sends 2, and in the same way the Lord sends you. Find out what you're getting into. He wants you to leave Egypt and he wants you to enter into the promised land. But he also wants you to know what you're getting into. Second half of verse 1 tells us about when the spies arrive. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab, and they lodged there. Now, it's a fair question. What are they doing there? Why would these godly men, spies of God's people, on a mission from God to enter the promised land, how do they end up at the home of a hooker? Well, there's a couple of explanations. First of all, understand that the word harlot here in Joshua in Hebrew can be translated innkeeper in the sense of a host or hostess. And if you want to go with that, I guess you could, but realize that in the New Testament, when Rahab is mentioned, she's called a prostitute. It's the Greek word porne, where we get porn and pornography. She was a woman who sold her body for money. That was her station in life. And probably was an inn, kind of a tavern. You know, you come in, you can eat, you can drink, you can spend the night, that kind of a thing. And that's who she was. She was a harlot. Now you have to ask why were they there? How did they end up there? And you might want to assume that they were up to no good. They were up to monkey business. You know, the cats away, the mice will play, kind of a thing. But that's not it at all. Because if you're a traveler and come to Jericho, a stranger from some other land, you go to the inn, whether it's a house of prostitution or not. You blend in with all the other strangers that are there. It's where travelers went. Strangers weren't noticed, where strangers were expected. So they get to the home of Rahab, the harlot, and they lodged there. Verses 2 through 7 tell us now about another questionable situation, because they tell us all about the way that she lies. The spies arrive and then the harlot lies. It was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, these men have come here tonight from Israel to search out the country." You know, they knew what was up. And interestingly enough, they knew where they were. And so in spite of their attempts to kind of blend in, they knew right where they were. So the king sent to Rahab, said, "Bring them out. You know, they've come to search out the country." He knew why they were there. And in verse 4, she says, "Well, they came to me, but I didn't know where they were from." There's lie number one. "And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, the men went out." You know, when they were closing the gate, the guys slipped out. Well, lie number two. "Go after them, quick, you might catch them." Talk about a wild goose chase. That's what she's doing. I guess, is that lie number three, maybe kind of, sort of? And so the question comes up, this moral question, is it ever okay to lie? And that is a deep ethical question. You can take that all kinds of directions. You can get very theological about it, and you can discuss God's perfect will versus God's permissive will. You know, there's God's best, and then there's God's best polluted by faulty human wisdom. Now, we know that it's never okay to sin. But don't forget this, that there's always forgiveness. Maybe there was a better way she could have handled it. But for a godless woman who eked out survival by catering to the most base, animalistic cravings of fallen man, her heart was sure in the right place to protect God's people, which leads us right into really the next lesson in verses 8 through 21. When you're ready to leave the desert, you're going to find help where you least expect it. I mean, these guys knew where to go, where they could find a room, where they could find, you know, a meal. But were, do you think they were expecting the innkeeper, the madam, to actually aid them in their quest? Probably they weren't expecting that. But when God's involved, you're going to find help sometimes where you least expect it. Verse 8. "Now before they lay down," that is before they went to bed, "she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you.'" Well, that's a helpful report for them, don't you think? See, what she knew about the Lord was enough to make her risk everything to help the spies. Notice in verse 9, there's three things that she knew. She knew that the Lord has given you the land. She knew that. The Lord's given you this land. Now, there's a lot of implications there. That means that the Lord was going to be with them when they came to take it. That means that since she wasn't one of them, she would probably most likely be among those who were killed in the battle and all the rest. She knows the Lord's given them the land. The second thing it tells us in the second part of that verse is that the terror of you, the terror of Israel, has fallen on us. She says, "I know this." However many hundreds of thousands or a million Israelites camped across the river, it definitely wasn't a secret they were there. You could see the smoke from their campfires and all the rest. And these people, according to Rahab, were shaken in their boots. These guys are going to come and wipe us out. And she says, we know that. She knew that. And then the third thing that she knew was that the inhabitants of the land, she says, are faint-hearted because of you. They aren't gathering up their swords and their weapons. They're freaking out. They're looking at this camp and they're saying, we're done for. We don't have a chance. Well, that's right where Joshua and the Israelites want them to be. And here's a real interesting Bible note. Back in Exodus chapter 15, you remember the story. This is right, the Red Sea parted and the Israelites crossed, and then the Egyptian army came in, the water crashed down on them. And in chapter 15 of Exodus is the song of Moses. Moses composed this, kind of like the song that Mary sang, you know, the Magnificat. And Moses now, you know, writes this song to the Lord, fresh, you know, with from their deliverance from Egypt. And in verse 14, it says, you in your mercy have led forth the people whom you have redeemed. You've guided them in your strength to your holy habitation. The people, that is the people there, will hear and be afraid. Sorrow will take hold of the inhabitants of Philistia. That's another name for the land they're about to enter. So as prophesied by Moses 40 years earlier, under the inspiration of the Spirit, that's exactly what happens. And because of what she knew, she was prepared to risk everything, her very life, to help these spies. You know, hearing about the Lord caused Rahab to believe in the Lord. From what she learned about the Lord, she came to believe in him to the point that she was willing to risk her life to help God's people conquer her own people. Look at verse 10. And this is, she's speaking here. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. See, she knew about that. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, I think that's Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed, and you can read about that in Numbers around chapter 13, if memory serves me right. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth below. Now that's quite a claim. That's quite a statement for this unbeliever, pagan prostitute. You know, really, verses 10 and 11 here, this is more a testimony to God than it is to her. She'd heard about it, but God actually did these things. And through these things that she just talked about, that we just read, he touched her life right where she was. She didn't have to come across the river to the Israelites to learn enough to put her faith in the God who created heaven and created the earth. He came to her right where she was. She came to believe in him and then used her situation to serve him. Way more than just an observer, a spectator, she's going to use her place, her house built into the wall of Jericho, to serve the Lord and to help accomplish his purpose. My buddy up in Seattle, a few years ago, their church moved. They were meeting in an old school in the Ballard area of Seattle, and the school district wanted to take the school back. It was an empty school, but the school district was going to take it back and turn it into an office or something like that. So this whole church with, you know, several hundred people now scrambling to find a place to meet. Well, there was up north of Seattle an old grocery store. It was a Thriftway or something like that. And it was empty, and it was big enough. They saw how they could just kind of build a shell inside of it and have a worship place, a sanctuary, and all around the outside they could build out offices and Sunday school rooms. But and it was a great opportunity. But part of that purchase was this strip mall. You couldn't buy just a piece of it. You had to buy the whole thing. So you've got the old grocery store, and then you've got the right next to it, this strip mall that had a post office and, like, you know, a nail and tanning salon. Never been, you know. And a tavern. So the church shells out, I don't know how many million, to buy this property. including the tavern. Well, of course, there were some people who just assumed, well, as soon as we sign the papers, we'll be telling those tavern people to find another place, because after all, the church owns the property and we can't. But no. My buddy Wayne had a whole different approach. He said, who needs church? Who needs Christian people? Who needs to be influenced by the things of God more than the owners and patrons of a tavern? This is one of those deals where they open at 7 o'clock in the morning and there's guys on stools already in there, you know. And so they bought the whole place and they didn't kick anybody out. They used that as an opportunity. You know, people said, kick them out. And Wayne said, no, bring them in. Talk about an impact on the owners. Can you imagine the first time the pastor walks into the tavern, you know, with some papers, and they're thinking, oh, this is it. We're out of here. Here's our eviction notice. No. I think maybe, you know, maybe he even lowered the rent or something. I don't know. But he was just, oh, we're glad to have you. Here's how this is going to work. Everything's fine. You stay where you are. We're going to put our junior high group down here and our high school group over here. And you're going to be right in the middle. And whether you like it or not, they're going to be praying for you. And, you know, have a nice day. You know, kind of a thing. See, in that case, the Lord used the believers to reach out to the tavern people. Now, in this case, it's the Lord using the tavern people to help the believers with Rahab. But that's how the Lord works, providing help where you least expect it. But see, the story's not over. Rahab wanted their help too. She was helping them, but she wanted their help too. Verse 12, now therefore I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I've shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and my family, and give me a true token, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. So the man answered her, our lives for yours. If none of you tell this business of ours, and it shall be when the Lord has given us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you. See, her concern wasn't just for herself. She had it in mind that her whole family would be saved. Now, first she hid the spies. Then she helped them escape. Verse 15, she let them down a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. You know, these walls were, Jericho, according to the historians, had a double wall, and each one was about 15 feet thick. And so inside the wall were houses or apartments, and she lived in one of those, one of the upper floors, because she lowered them down by a rope. And she said to him, get to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterward, you may go your way. The mountains, you have to understand, are the other way. The mountains are behind Jericho. The river's this way, and the Israelites are over there. And she says, you guys go hide in the mountains, which means they had to go back. They had to go back deeper into enemy territory. Pick it up at verse 17. So the man said to her, we will be blameless of this oath of yours, which you've made us swear, unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your own home, so it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head and we'll be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath which you made us swear. And she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent him away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord to the window. The scarlet cord, the rope of hope. He said, tie this scarlet cord to the rope and let it hang out the window. And when we attack, we'll see the cord. We'll know everybody in that house will be saved. That was the agreement. That was the deal. Now, this is one of those beautiful typologies of the Bible. And of course, the Jewish readers would pick right up on this. The scarlet blood of the Passover lamb is what brought about the rescue of the Israelites from Egypt, that place of slavery and sin. And this scarlet cord would bring about the rescue of Rahab and her whole family. And years later, the scarlet blood of the cross would bring about our rescue from our Egypt, our salvation from slavery to sin. And then there's a fourth one, the scarlet wine of communion, that signifies the blood of the new covenant, wherein our Joshua, our Yeshua, our Jesus, leads us into the Spirit-filled life, the promised land. And what he asks us to do is trust him the same way that Rahab trusted that scarlet rope. God is going to help you when you least expect it. And as you move further into his promises, you're saved, you're forgiven, but you move further into the life that he promises you, you're going to get help when you least expect it. Okay, one more thing. When you're ready to leave the desert, you're going to find the Lord working weekends. They departed and went to the mountain, just like she told them to, and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers returned. The pursuers sought them all along the way but didn't find them. So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, and crossed over, that would be the Jordan, and they came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him all that had befallen them. Told him, the people know we're coming. They're shaking in their boots. Their hearts have melted. They're faint-hearted. And there's this gal, Rahab, who's got a rope hanging out her window, and there's a scarlet cord, and her whole family, we promised them we'd save. And they said to Joshua, truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us. You know, the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands. It took 3 days here. You notice that in chapter 1, there was a mention of 3 days too. The Lord can do a lot in 3 days, even when, from your perspective, nothing's happening. And here we are enjoying this 3-day weekend, most of us are. But a lot can happen in 3 days. You know, when Moses was dealing with the Egyptians and Pharaoh, they were without light for 3 days, considering this God of the Hebrews who had the ability to darken the whole world. Jonah, of course, was in the belly of a big fish for 3 days, had time to think about what God had asked him to do and how his plan was working out and how maybe doing things God's way would go a little better for him. The most obvious of all, our Lord Jesus, in the belly of the earth for 3 days, and we learn from 1 Peter, he was proclaiming the gospel in the spirit world, 3 days. After 3 days of searching, these soldiers, they gave up, and the spies were able to return safely to Joshua. A whole lot can happen in 3 days when God is at work. He's preparing you to enter into the fullness of his promises to you. That's not downtime. It's not wasted time. You may not know what he's doing. You may not see that he's doing anything. But he's at work all the time. When nothing seems to be happening, know that the Lord is at work preparing you, protecting you, waiting for the right time and the right situation to bring you into what he has for you. You know, it's time to move beyond the first half of God's promise. It's time to leave the desert, desert the desert, and move forward. And here's the question. If you're not moving forward, what's stopping you? What's holding you back? Is this a time of preparation, or is it just a time of procrastination? Is the Lord readying you or readying the circumstances for you to move forward, or are you just putting it off and holding yourself back? Are you struggling to make progress, or are you snuggling in right where you are? Because if that's the case, let me warn you, there are 2.5 tribes that stayed on the other side of the Jordan. They took that as their inheritance. They settled in, they built homes, they planted gardens, they raised kids, and everything was good for a while. Years later, when the Assyrians came, they were the first ones taken captive. If you're snuggling in where you are, give that some serious thought. You know, forgiveness of sin through faith in Jesus is more than any of us deserve, but there's more. There is so much more when you trust Him completely. Let's be those people who describe their lives as flowing with every good thing from God.